Turning today to the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 12 and verse 1. The Acts of the Apostles, chapter 12, verse 1. Now, about that time, Herod the king, Herod Agrippa the first, stretched forth his hands to vex certain of the church. And our subject is flesh against spirit. And what a chapter this is, which is before us. It could only appear in inspired history, in the Word of God. It is in its record and in the things which it presents and the manner in which it presents them, the themes and the applications so magnificently constructed. Well, it's the final chapter, in a sense, in the Acts of the Apostles, recording the progress of the gospel among the Jews in Jerusalem and in Judea, because the spotlight will soon switch to the Gentile mission, almost entirely. But here, in this closing chapter of the Jewish phase, now about that time, Herod the king stretched forth his hands to vex certain of the church. There's a key word in the verse, which is vex, and it's a word which is used more in the English language today about small annoyances and troubles and distresses. But that's not what the word intends in the mind of our King James translators, because it translates a Greek word which means something like render worthless. To kill, yes, but to render of no effect or worthless the object of the persecution. And about that time, Herod the king, not the Herod of the Gospels, the nephew of Herod the Tetrarch of the Gospels, but Herod Agrippa the first, stretched forth his hands to vex or to render useless or worthless to the church, key leaders of the church. It was a planned thing altogether. It was a strategy that Herod decided to adopt to try to crush or eliminate the church of Jesus Christ and the church in Jerusalem in particular by eliminating its key leaders. It wasn't easy to do because the apostles were not in Jerusalem much of the time. And in fact, the church at Jerusalem and its day-to-day administration, if you like, its spiritual care, had passed now into the hands of appointed elders. You see that, well, the apostles were elders as well as being apostles, but you can see that the responsibility had moved in verse 30 of the previous chapter, sent it to the elders when relief for the famine that was coming about in Jerusalem was to be sent from the Gentile churches. They sent it to the elders, not to the apostles. Where were the apostles? Well, they were largely out of Jerusalem. They were in Judea, ministering, evangelizing to Jewish people. But James, the brother of John, it appears, had come into Jerusalem, and that's what they would do. They would return from time to time, report to the church at Jerusalem, minister among their own, and then set off on another itinerary, another journey. But while James was in Jerusalem, he was apprehended by Herod's officers. He was, of course, Herod, the Roman authority, by Roman soldiers, and he was killed. Verse 2, he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. With the sword probably indicates that he was beheaded. And verse 3, because he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter also. Now the language is of enormous significance, and I want to try to get this across. So the first heading of my message this morning, in this flesh and spirit, how the flesh is against the spirit, and Satan uses fallen human nature to resist and oppose the work of the Spirit of God and the gospel and the conversion of souls. But my first heading is the pride and the theatre of the flesh. You see it in Herod. He's got a scheme. Why is Herod so concerned to destroy or hinder the Church of Christ if he can? Why doesn't he leave it alone? He's a Roman authority. Well, because he knows this is his scheme. This will make him immensely popular with the leaders of the Jews, the chief priests, the scribes, and the Pharisees. It's some 14 years since the crucifixion of Christ, and the church has grown and grown. And even though there has been persecution before, which has scattered the people and driven them out throughout Judea and Samaria and Galilee, of course, nevertheless, there are still thousands in Jerusalem. It's estimated up to 30,000 in the church in Jerusalem. Of course, still only a fraction of the population of Jerusalem. But he's going to hinder and destroy the church. And that pleases the Jewish leaders and the majority of Jewish people who hate the Church of Jesus Christ, sadly. And how is he going to ingratiate himself with the Jews and do this? He's going to be a tremendous opponent of the church. He experiments. He's careful. He's going to take James first, perhaps the first disciple to return to Jerusalem for some time, first of the apostles. And if that goes down well, if it has the desired effect, then he will carry out his larger plan. The language really reveals the plan. Verse 3, because he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further, and the Greek implies in the carrying out of his scheme. He's got a plan. His plan is to take Peter also as soon as he enters the city. Why is his plan focused on Peter? Well, because Peter is the principal apostle, it appears. He is the one, according to the record of Acts, who's been most conspicuous among the apostles so far. And he is the one who represents more clearly than any other the firm belief of Christians that Christ is still alive, that he rose from the dead. It's the apostles who primarily witnessed the resurrection. It's Peter who was enabled after Pentecost, first of all, to do great works like the works of Christ. It's Peter who, in his person and in his preaching and in his representing of Christ and witnessing to Christ, effectively says, look, he is alive. He has risen from the dead. And all the works he did among you and all the healings, we, his apostles, have been given power to do, to indicate that now he is truly risen and he's in heaven. If we can take Peter, and oh, thinks Herod, if we can take him, this is an ideal time of the year, at the Passover. It was at Passover that Christ was crucified. If we can take Peter and treat him just as Christ was treated, and we can have a trial immediately to please the Jews, not to offend them, immediately after the Passover, and a great public screaming mob shouting against him, and then we can execute him. Why, in a sense, we're reproducing what happened to Christ. To Jesus Christ, not exactly, of course, but it's the same time, same feast, same kind of thing, only, says Herod, we will not put him on a cross. Oh no, there is the myth, that's what he believes it is, that Christ rose again from the dead. So we're not putting him on a cross, we're going to behead him. And publicly, that's what he's done to James. The very language by the sword suggests a decapitation of James, and that'll put a final end. So the one who is the representative of the teaching that Christ rose again and is alive and is the chief among the apostles who continues to do the works of Christ, if we can eliminate and end him, well, surely that will be the beginning of the end for the Christian church. That is the scheme of Herod. When you read the passage and you look at the implications of the language, that's his plan. And I can indicate more to you along these lines as we go through. He killed James, the brother of John, with the sword, and because he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter also. Then were the days of unleavened bread, the time of the Passover. So the test is passed. The elimination of James pleases the Jewish leaders and the Jews. He's succeeding. And now you see the power of the flesh, the showmanship, the theatre. He loved to dress up, did Herod Agrippa. We'll see more about this at the end of the chapter. But look at the power, the Roman power, and his in particular. Verse 4, when he had apprehended him, he put him in prison, not the common prison. Oh, he knew all about how years previously all the apostles had been put in the common prison by the chief priests. And, oh, says Herod scornfully, it is said that an angel of the Lord delivered them and led them out. Well, we're going to make sure that they don't get out this time. And he put him in his own prison there in Jerusalem, attaching the Roman garrison, the fort, there was a prison, and delivered him to four quaternions of soldiers. That's four fours, literally. They were not the only soldiers on duty. Two would be in the cell with Peter, one arm chained to one of them. So a guard on each side of the four, men appointed to guard him especially. He chained each arm to one of them, and then two especially manning the door of the cell. And of course there were other guards. This is just the quaternion, appointed on pain of their lives not to let him go. So there were four groups of four, and some say they would have been 6 hours on duty, some say 3 hours on duty, and that term of duty repeated during the course of the night. So that's the most likely, a 3 hour stint they had to stay awake to keep him, intending after Easter, a very curious piece of helpfulness to us by the King James translators. It isn't Easter, of course, it's Passover. Intending after Passover, look at this, to bring him forth to the people. You see, this is going to be a great public event. Of course, the people won't be a jury, but he will be tried by Herod. He will be condemned. He will be sentenced. And all the people, the chief priests, the scribes, the Pharisees, and thousands of Jewish people, and there'll be many extra people in the city because of the Passover. It will be crowded out, and they will all scream and shout for his life, and then it will be terminated, most decisively, no doubt, by beheading. But the idea is to bring him forth to the people. It's theatre, you see. It's a great spectacle. It's going to end, so thinks Herod, the history of the church. Verse 5, Peter therefore was kept in prison. But, and now we have the quiet prayer, the quiet power, rather, of the Spirit. But prayer was made without ceasing by the church unto God for him. Prayer was made. There were not demonstrations organized. There was no kind of militia organized. There was no panic like that, not noise and clamor, but the quiet power of the Spirit. By contrast with the noise and clamor and theater and open, exhibited power of the flesh, the secret, quiet power of the Spirit is depended upon. Prayer was made without ceasing for him, for his life. Now they knew that they couldn't, they had no promise of God that his life would be spared. After all, James had been allowed to die, the brother of John. And that's incidentally an interesting reflection that James was probably the first apostle to suffer martyrdom, and John, his brother, probably the last apostle to suffer martyrdom. The two brothers were first and last. So he'd been allowed to die, but they could plead for the life of Peter, how much they loved him and needed him and wanted him. And they did plead for his life. They would certainly plead that he would have strength. What did this trial mean for Peter? Probably a scourging. It doesn't mention it in the text, so it was never done. But that would have been a preparation for his execution on the day of the trial, before or after his condemnation. They would have scourged him. He would have to have gone through terrible things. And they pray for Peter that he'll stand nobly, that he'll be strengthened. It doesn't seem to be an answer to the prayer as they go on night and day after night and day, until the very night before the event. Passover is over. It's been announced. The concourse, the people will gather. They're ready to scream and shout against him. The hostile people in Jerusalem, that is, and the chief priests. Look at verse 6. When Herod would have brought him forth during the night leading up to that, the same night Peter was sleeping between two soldiers bound with two chains, and the keepers before the door kept the prison. That is his part of the prison. He was in an inner prison. You'll see that a little later. And behold, verse 7, the angel of the Lord came upon him, and a light shined in the prison. The guards seemed to have been put into a deep slumber. These men charged on pain of their lives with not letting him go. If Peter stirred in his sleep, he would disturb them. But Peter is asleep. He's fast asleep. Why, that's a testimony in itself. And I can tell you, and you'll know it if you've read sermons of past worthies, that Peter's sleep has been the subject of many sermons. How well he slept. What a testimony. He trusted the Lord the night before his trial and execution. He can sleep. Would you sleep? By the help of the Lord and confidence in the Lord, he slept. And he slept pretty deeply too. He had to be struck quite hard by the angel of the Lord to wake him up. And even then he didn't fully wake up. He was, as it were, in a trance, stumbling about, following instructions crisply given by the angel. Behold, the angel of the Lord came upon him, and a light shined in the prison, or that particular cell. It had been in total darkness. Nobody awoke except Peter. He smote Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, "Arise up quickly." Quickly? Why quickly? Certainly not because the angel of the Lord was afraid the guards would wake up. There was no fear. He had everything under control. They were, as it were, anesthetized. They weren't waking up. Nor was anyone else in that prison. But quickly, for Peter's sake. How kind is God when he deals with us. Peter isn't going to be given time to have any doubts about this. He isn't going to be given any time to think to himself, "I can't escape from here. If I escape from here, there'll be a manhunt, and all the disciples will be hauled out and imprisoned, and many will be executed, men and women and children. I can't go. It would cause much too much trouble." Peter isn't going to be allowed to think of others or harbor any doubts. That's why the angel says, "Get up quickly." And he just feeds him instructions. Wonderful words at the end of verse 7. And his chains fell off from his hands. They were fastened, probably not by locks like modern handcuffs, but by screw devices to fasten the shackles on him. But they just fell off. his hands. And the angel said unto him, verse 8, gird thyself, bind on thy sandals. And so he did, exactly as he was told. And he saith unto him, cast thy garment about thee and follow me. Why so much detail? It's getting across to us that Peter, in his stupor, his sleep had been so good, needed precise instructions, one following another. And verse 9, he went out and followed the angel, and wist not that it was true which was done by the angel, but thought he saw a vision. His mind is racing. Verse 10, when they were past the first and the second ward, is his departments in the prison, and those were no doubt filled. There were all kinds of people, miscreants in those wards and their guards, but nobody was disturbed. They went through the first, they went through the second. Peter had been in an inner prison. They came unto the iron gate that leadeth unto the city. Well, you know what English prisons are like, and so many of them were built in Victorian times and not long after, and they have the same formidable gates. They're probably familiar to your view because you've seen pictures of them many times, and everybody can see, oh, that's a prison gate. It was rather like that in Jerusalem. For the Roman prison, there was this great iron gate locked firmly, and yet it swung open, apparently, by itself. And through they went, and they passed on through one street, major street, turning, it appears, into a side street. And forthwith the angel departed from him. Verse 11, and when Peter was come to himself, his full consciousness is restored. He knows what's happened. He's certain of everything. Now I know of a surety that the Lord hath sent his angel and hath delivered me out of the hand of Herod. And look at these words at the end of verse 11. They are very, very significant in my narrative. And from the expectation of the people of the Jews. It wasn't just Herod and his Roman garrison. This was all pre-announced. This was all arranged that very morning Peter would be taken and there would be a great trial, a show trial, and then there would be his execution. And the unbelievers, the host hostile to the church, were looking forward to it grimly. The expectation of the people of the Jews. And verse 12, when he had considered the thing, what do you imagine he considered? Well, any number of things, but included would be this. Now, I have to tell the church. I have to tell the people who are at prayer for me. And I have to get this message to James, who is the chief among the elders. Not, of course, the James, who is was the apostle who has been executed, probably beheaded. But this is James, the half-brother of Jesus, who we know from his epistles and elsewhere was in the book of Acts, was the principal elder of the church at Jerusalem now. And he must get a message to him. And then he thinks, then I must go into hiding, because there'll be fury when they find I've gone. And all the main houses, and Mary, the mother of John Mark, where one of the prayer meetings is being held, they know all about that household. They know they're believers, and they'll be raided, and they'll be looking for me. So when he had considered the thing, in the light of this danger, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark. John, his Hebrew name. Mark, his Latin name. Where many were gathered together praying. Many. It's the early hours of the morning. It must be. We know that all was dark when he was released. We know he's going to be, his loss, the fact that he's missing, is going to be discovered at daybreak. That prayer meeting is going on in the early hours. I would estimate that it must be 4 o'clock in the morning or thereabouts. And there's a prayer meeting still in progress. And there are not just four or five or six. There are many. Mary has a large house, but is crammed full of people. So that's where he goes. And then there is the event with Rhoda. And here is the quiet power of the Spirit, by contrast with all the theatre and hatred and noise and commotion of the world. Verse 13, as Peter knocked at the door of the gate, there's an outer gate, probably a metal gate, and then there's a sort of porch, and then an inner door, and he knocks, but not very loudly. You don't want to disturb the neighbours. You don't want people to know what's going on here, especially if the Roman soldiers are going to come shortly. So he knocks quietly, and a damsel came to hearken, a maid named Rhoda, which means rose. Rhoda heard that knock. Some probably didn't hear it. It was quiet. When she knew Peter's voice, because she went to listen, the text says, "Who's there?" she asked. And she heard Peter's voice. And we may have thought that Rose was quite a silly girl, because verse 14, when she knew Peter's voice, she opened not the gate for gladness, but ran in. And you picture her getting into a dither and forgetting to open the door. But you know, I don't think that's right. I don't think she was dithering or lost her concentration at all. Because the picture was something like this. That prayer meeting was a place of danger. That prayer meeting was a gathering that could have been raided at any time. That's the atmosphere in which the early church at this time was conducting itself. Persecution had been renewed and mounted. A knock at night could mean anything. Perhaps it had been reported that there was a crowd, a great crowd of people, and a great murmur of praying voices, and the amens from this house. And Rhoda, well, she was the one who customarily answered the door. She was a maid. Some people say she was a slave. I don't believe she was a slave. It doesn't say so. But she was a maiden in the house. And when she heard this knock, she didn't say, "Somebody answer it." It's probably the military at the door. Somebody answer it. She went herself. She knew that it was the maid's job to say, "Who's there?" Anyone else would have aroused instant suspicions. So she was a Rhoda Rose. She had great courage. She went herself. And she called out, "Who's there?" And when Peter answered, and she recognized his voice, though it was, the reply was very low, she was so relieved. This was a relief of tension, great tension in my mind, that caused her to rush back to the others and say, "It's Peter, it's the apostle." Well, of course, as soon as they heard that, at least they didn't believe her. They couldn't imagine, they couldn't grasp it. But if she heard what she thought was Peter's voice, if there was anyone out there, it was a Galilean. And if it was a Galilean, it couldn't be a Roman soldier. So there was probably great relief. I suspect that they had said, or one or two had said to Rhoda, "Well, if you're answering the door, signal if it's hostile." And there was a hush in that prayer meeting. And some of the men and some of the leaders of the church were all ready, which was sensible, to slip out on the roof and down a side passage and get away before the place was entered. And Rhoda went to the door knowing that if it was hostile, those Roman soldiers would soon burst in and thrust her through or cast her aside and show violence, great violence to her. But she went. "Who's there?" he said. And she was so relieved to hear Peter's voice. So, well, that's my construction of it. I don't think she was just a dithering, silly girl who ran back into the house, forgetting to open the door. But they said, oh, it's his angel, the sort of thing people say when they don't know what to say, but they don't really believe you. They'd prayed for Peter's life, but they were overawed by the power of Rome and the imprisonment and the character of his imprisonment. And they really had much more faith in the power of God to strengthen and help him than to release him. But how overwhelmed they were. Well, I must carry on because Peter comes in. Time is almost running short. Verse 14, when she knew Peter's voice, she opened up the gate for gladness, but ran in and told how Peter stood before the gate. And they said unto her, thou art mad. You're crazy, Rhoda. But she constantly affirmed that it was even so. Then said they, it is his angel. And verse 16, Peter continued knocking outside. He'd heard Rhoda's voice. What's the matter with them in there, he thinks. And when they had opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. But he, beckoning unto them, the Greek word translated beckoning unto them says something like motioning downwards to them. You can imagine that, can't you? Shh, shh, don't say anything. Let me get my explanation over. Then I must go. He, beckoning unto them, rather hushing them down, with his hand to hold their peace, declared unto them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, go, show these things unto James, half-brother of the Lord, senior elder of the church at Jerusalem, and to the brethren. And he departed and went into another place, where it doesn't say. Well, that would have been a secret at the time. But someone who loved the Lord, probably just outside the city, who knows, at the Mount of Olives, at Bethany, somewhere like that, he slipped away where he wouldn't be found if the searches were conducted. Now verse 18, as soon as it was day, understatement by Luke, there was no small stir among the soldiers. There was tremendous alarm, particularly on the part of the quaternium, the four who would lose their lives if they lost a prisoner. What was become of Peter? And verse 19, when Herod had sought for him and found him not, he examined the keepers and commanded that they should be put to death. I don't think they were, actually, but this is only my view. Because Herod Agrippa I is going to lose his life in just a moment. And maybe his last orders and commands were never carried out. And so the angel's deliverance of Peter turned out to be totally peaceful. That's what I imagine anyway. But I'm here to preach the truth of the gospel, not to write novels. So you don't have to accept that version of events. But there you are. But they were commanded to be put to death. And then in verse 19, the end, he went down, Herod that is, from Judea to Caesarea and there abode. Well, what happened to that great assembly? What was he going to do? He had no prisoner. His plans were completely thwarted. He ran out of town. He went back to Caesarea. Mark you, he didn't have much time because there was a great event planned in Caesarea also. We know that from Josephus and secular history. Why, the Emperor Claudius had visited Britain. He'd visited Britain, so the historians tell us, for 16 days. He was no great soldier, though during his reign there were great conquests. The conquest of Britain, for example. And he turned up just for the last 16 days. And history tells us that Claudius Caesar witnessed the collapse of Colchester and then promptly sailed home to take the victory salutes. And there was a great event planned in Caesarea for that entire region at which Herod Agrippa would preside. And he was due there. He didn't have time to sort out the mess he'd left in Jerusalem. He could only give instructions for the great concourse the following day to be dispersed. He'd gone. There was no prisoner. There was no Peter. But then there's a account of what took place. Look at the quiet power of the Spirit. Verse 20, Herod was highly displeased with the people of Tyre and Zidon up in the north. That really strictly was part of Syria. And he blocked food supplies to Tyre and Zidon, very wealthy ports. But for some reason there was a dispute. He blocked food supplies, and Tyre and Zidon had bribed his chamberlain and come pleading for clemency. And Herod decided to give in and let them have their food. And so he decided, I think, to combine this with the special event, the festivity for the victory over Britain, the great the worship of Claudius. And so he put on his robes, verse 21, upon a set day. That's language which denotes a special occasion. Upon a set day, it was already arranged. Herod arrayed in royal apparel. Josephus said he glinted of silver threads. Sat upon his throne and made an oration, a speech unto them. And the people, this is the people of Tyre and Zidon, gave a shout. It's the voice of a god and not of a man. The Romans that were present in Caesarea, they wouldn't have shouted that. That would have been insulting to Claudius, the real emperor. The Jews would never have said that. For all their sins and their faults, they would never have cried out that Herod was a god. This was the people who'd had the benefit of his peace that he declared, the people of Tyre and Zidon. But he accepted it. He let it happen. And he reveled in it, being praised as a god. And immediately the angel of God smote him because he gave not God the glory. Of course, a secular reader will say God punished him because he accepted the praise of the people of Tyre and Zidon that he was a god. But it's bigger than that. God punished him because he blasphemed against Christ, and his whole campaign was to bring down the church, and he sought to rain blow after blow upon it and bring it to an end. And he was an unbeliever, and he scorned that ever there'd been the power of God with the church, and the miracles had been true, and that people had been delivered from prison before. He spurned all that and thought he could put it to an end. He gave not God the glory, and he was eaten of worms. Oh, that excites a lot of attention. And those of scientific bent try to find out how a person could die in this manner and how often it's happened or hasn't happened and so on. But this is probably a unique punishment of God. It's said to have been afflicted by an angel. It doesn't necessarily fit into anything that could be medically explained. But it must have been a terrible sight to see. A man dying, bursting of worms. How revolting. How shameful. What a signal way of indicating that he was repulsive to God, because he gave not God the glory and he vaunted himself. But here's the significance of it all, because I must really come to conclusion. It ended the persecution. Verse 24, the word of God grew and multiplied. It ended the persecution completely. And as I say, probably the execution even of those Roman guards. The Jewish leaders were silenced and made to consider. Herod was going to end the church. And in fact, it is he who had his career ended. He'd reigned for 7 years. He was aged 54. He was, up to this time, probably in the best of health. The bust of Herod Agrippa I that appears on coins shows a very powerful man with a broad, strong face and a noble nose, thick set, powerful. And yet his life is ended in this manner. Peter lives. Here's the result of the quiet power of the Spirit. There's no further disgracing of Christ now for some while. Herod Agrippa perishes for blasphemy. What an embarrassment to the chief priests and the scribes. That was disgusting even to them. They'd thrown all their weight behind Herod Agrippa. And it's the mercy of God. This really could be a final heading, but I've no time. It's the mercy of God. It isn't just the deliverance of Peter. It isn't just the ending of the persecution. It's the mercy of God to those Jews in Jerusalem. They have now just 25 years to go before AD 70, 26 years, the destruction of Jerusalem. The ending of the era of Jewish privilege is 25 years left of grace for the city of Jerusalem and of mercy. And the way God ends the persecution and delivers Peter in such a manner that the people are caused to wonder and stand amazed. A prayer meeting can accomplish so much. A prayer meeting can overpower Herod Agrippa's hate and determination. And it can. You come to the prayer meeting tomorrow night, dear friends. A prayer meeting overturned the power of the Praetorian Guard. The quartetion of soldiers who were to keep Peter in captivity. A prayer meeting can overpower the temple police. A prayer meeting can overpower all the hatred of the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees. A prayer meeting can overpower chains and iron doors and keep mercy flowing and keep the gospel alive and being preached. And our prayer meeting tomorrow night can overthrow apathy in human hearts and ignorance and love of materialism, and all the power of the brainwashing of the world, and love of sin, and the distractions and unbelief planted in the mind by Satan. Prayer meetings have such power, as you see the contrast here. The power of the flesh, the theatre of the flesh, the hostility of the flesh to the Spirit. Dear friends, when I'm dead and gone, never give up the separate prayer meeting from the Bible study. Keep the old traditions alive. Never say, oh, it would be much more convenient if we have two meetings and just combine them into one. Why ever do I mention this? Because it's happening all over the country. It's so sad, dear friends, when you think of the power of a prayer meeting. It's God's will, it's ordained by him, it's what he hears, it's what he uses, the quiet power of the Spirit. And when people say to you, oh, the world, the flesh, makes such a lot of noise. People now for weeks have been watching the television, spectacle to begin the Olympics, spectacle to end it, then the Paralympics, more spectacle, great spectacles, worked up excitement. I'm not criticizing sport or sporting festivities, but you see what the world does at the present time, constantly trying to rule people's minds by spectacles and noise and commotion and celebration, worked up excitement, even the music of the world. It's a stunning audio drug, compelling people to think and desire as the world wants it to. And some Christian people say, if we're going to make an impression on the world, we've got to do the same. So bring on the bands and the noise and the rhythms, the tempos. Bring on the glamorous and the big and the strobe lights and everything. In the service of Christ, what's this 12th chapter of Acts all about? The tremendous contrast between the flesh and the Spirit. And that night prayer meeting overpowered all the power and theatre of Agrippa, Herod Agrippa, and the flesh. So it is today. Even some preachers. Now you're bound to get excited in preaching, and you're bound to be a little larger than life, but some preachers make the mistake of thinking they've got to shrill and shout their heads off, as though power is in decibels. The quiet, contrasting power of the Holy Spirit. God doesn't need all that, and he doesn't want all that, and it is distasteful to him. And here, in the divine history of Acts 12, you get the way in which God works, the way in which he carries out his purposes. Dear friends, I'm over time. That's enough for us today. Always treasure the quiet work of the Spirit of God. Let's close by singing hymn number 470.